It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll talk to the school administrator leading an effort to fix the racial achievement gap in Wisconsin education.
First, there's been a lot of debate in recent years over changing the size, scope, and budget of the United States military. There have been plenty of proposals on the table, and most recently, President Obama has called for a new round of defense cuts and the reduction of troop levels to pre-World War II levels.
But our next guest has another idea for reorganizing the military. It's a big one. Get rid of the United States Air Force. He says the country has need of air power, but not necessarily a separate air force. And he says the military would be better served by abolishing the branch and dividing its assets between the Army and the Navy.
We're joined now by Robert Farley. He's an assistant professor at the Patterson School of Diplomacy and International Commerce at the University of Kentucky. He's the author of Grounded, The Case for Abolishing the United States Air Force. Robert, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start right with your title. What is the case to be made for doing something this drastic, ending an entire branch of the U.S. military, in this case the Air Force?
Well, my argument is that while the United States needs air power, we need military aviation to support just about any kind of military operation or deterrence or anything else we want to conduct, that dividing and appropriating an entire service specifically to military aviation doesn't make sense in terms of the politics of how the military comes together. It doesn't make sense in terms of how the finances of the military come together. And finally, tends to create bureaucratic walls between organizations and between missions that tend to interrupt the way that military missions actually come together. And so having an Air Force is kind of an unnecessary bureaucratic reform that we embarked on in 1947, and it would be best for us to rethink that and to fold the assets into the other services.
Well, let's go back to 1947. What was the case for an independent Air Force? How did we end up there?
Well, the argument in 1947 was that the Air Force had, at least in large part, and this was the argument made by aviators, that the Air Force had virtually won the war, won World War II on its own. This was in both Europe and in the Pacific. And that especially if we'd had an independent Air Force prior to World War II, we would have been able to conduct two large, wide-scale strategic bombing campaigns against the German and Japanese homelands, and we would have been able to destroy their economies, bring their societies to a halt, and essentially force them to surrender without ever having to conduct D-Day. Of course, we didn't have to invade Japan, but that you could have won the war without the messy need to invade the continent and then to defeat the German army. And so the idea after World War II is that we should organize our military aviation assets around just this goal, around winning wars with aviation itself, with strategic bombing.
So you're saying that that made sense, you know, back in 1947, but today things have changed and we don't need to do that.
Well, I don't even. It was an idea that was contested in 1947. It was an idea that was contested before 1947, really. The arguments that were made back then were flawed in a lot of ways, and they were disagreed with by people in the other services. And so I think even from the vantage of 1947, looking at what had just happened in World War II, the decision to create an Air Force was based on a faulty assessment of what had actually gone on, that we needed to invade Europe. We did need to defeat the German army, and we did need to occupy pretty much all of Germany with four big armies. And so even from the vantage of World War II, it wasn't a good idea.
Running through your book is the idea that this notion that you just talked about, that we can win wars with air power almost by itself, makes it too easy for us to justify waging war. It provides a low-cost alternative for policymakers. How has that gotten us into trouble over the years?
Well, if you go back and look at several of the wars that the United States has had during the entire post-war period after World War II, there have been several cases in which the war starts with policymakers not having a really sensible appraisal of what all the costs would be. And, of course, you never know all of the costs that are going to be associated with war, so it's always a risky endeavor. But before the Vietnam War, some of the earliest predictions, and these came out of the Air Force and people associated with air power, were that Vietnam would be able to be forced out of the war, North Vietnam would be able to be forced out of the war through a strategic bombing campaign that would target their society, their industry, their infrastructure. And this eventually developed into something we call Rolling Thunder, and this failed. In Kosovo, which was a war that was, in fact, entirely won from the air eventually, or largely won from the air, the expectation was that the war would be much shorter, that it would be much cheaper, that Serbia could be defeated without much trouble. And I think that even in sort of the most recent cases, in fact, just a couple days ago, there was an Air Force colonel who proposed sending F-22s to Ukraine in order to deter and defeat the Russian Army and Air Force if they decided to invade Ukraine, which, in my view, would end up embroiling us in a pretty horrible war with the Russians that, at least if we only used F-22s, we would almost certainly lose.
Now, part of the argument that you make here is that military efforts require coordination and that the Air Force rolled into these other units could coordinate more effectively, and it's sort of redundant on the other side. But is there going to be a hidden cost to losing the consolidation of a single military branch, maybe that we can't even foresee right now?
Yeah, one of the arguments that the book makes is that every way we can think about organizing our bureaucracies, and this goes for the whole of government, it's not limited just to thinking about military affairs and to the military services, but there are going to be costs and benefits associated with every way that we have of thinking about putting our military together. And we are going to find that there are costs to, if we decide to go along with this plan, and if we decide to fold the Air Force back into the other services, we are going to find that there are costs, and some of these are going to be expected costs. We can expect probably that we will have fewer capabilities in something that's called global precision strike. We can expect that there may be fewer capabilities in terms of fast responsiveness in different parts of the globe. But that those are going to be outweighed by the benefits, and benefits in terms of the politics, where the president is going to have a better sense of what the options are, benefits in terms of eliminating redundancy and hopefully cutting cost in the Department of Defense. But it is, in the end, basically a value trade-off, that it comes down to what you want your military to do and what you don't want it to do, and just a sense of what you would really like to have.
We're talking right now with Robert Farley, who says the United States would be better off if we abolished the Air Force and divided its assets amongst the other branches of the military. And we'd love to know what you think. Would you be in favor of the idea, or do you see value in our country having a strong, independent Air Force? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with Professor Robert Farley of the University of Kentucky. In his new book, Grounded, he says that the United States should abolish the United States Air Force, divide up its assets and its missions between the Army and the Navy. What do you think? Do you think our military would benefit from that change? Do you think it's important, though, to retain a strong, independent Air Force? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send an email to talk@wpr.org. Go right to a caller now at 800-642-1234. We've got Brad on the line in Mequon. Brad, hi.
Hello. Just want to respond. I'm neutral regarding, for example, whether we fold the Air Force into the Army and the Navy. But I think one of the earlier points that the speaker mentioned, that by having a separate Air Force, there's a greater temptation to use air power to solve problems, I think would still be there, because you still would have the same number of planes, except they'd be divided among the Navy and the Army. And so someone would say, well, instead of using the Air Force to solve a problem without committing ground troops, let's use the Army Air Force to solve a problem without committing ground troops, and there would still be the same temptation.
Brad, thanks.
And I'll take my comment off the air.
Thanks for the call. Robert, do you buy that, or do you think there's something psychological about having, or maybe bureaucratic, about having a separate Air Force that leads us to think differently about how we intervene militarily?
Well, I mean, first I want to thank Brad for the comment, because it's an excellent question. Putting aviation assets into the Navy and into the Army accomplishes at least one thing from a political point of view. It means that there isn't a bureaucratic organization out there that is completely dedicated to the idea that aviation and air power is absolutely critical to American well-being and to the success of the American experiment, and that is competing with two other organizations for funding, for prominence, for procurement money, and really for a place in the sun. And so you don't have generals who are, and colonels who are sort of consciously or unconsciously, their professional and their political and their even their sort of their enthusiasms are all coming together around this idea that aviation is the tool that can solve problems. Instead, you have Navy admirals and Army generals who, at least hopefully, have a more holistic understanding of the use of military force and who don't think about solving particular problems just with one tool, but think about solving it with a combination of tools, and that this gives us and gives civilian policymakers a more full appraisal of what the costs and benefits of a war are going to be, right? So not just that war is going to be cheap and easy and we can solve it with bombs, but that, no, we might need this and this and this and this, and that gives us a better sense of what we're actually going to need.
Well, thank you much for that call. And Robert, one question might be, is the Army, is the Navy capable of absorbing an entire branch of the U.S. military? Now, there's not only logistical problems or at least technical challenges, but there's also an entire culture there to account for.
Right. At least in the case of the Army, we do have this historical example that for the first 30 years of American military aviation, the air service was controlled almost entirely by the Army. It was the Army Air Service, then the Army Air Corps, then eventually the Army Air Force. In World War II, the union of the Army and the Air Force was a much, much larger organization than the organization we have now, in terms of, the number of aircraft it had, in terms of the number of personnel that it had. There were cultural problems between the two parts of the organization, but they were fundamentally resolvable. So in terms of sheer size, I think the answer is yes. In terms of culture, I like to look at the Navy. The Navy has been incredibly successful with naval aviation over the years, such that its aviation team is regarded as just as successful as the Air Force's aviation team, in terms of putting fighters in the air, in terms of strike and so forth. And so I think there's already evidence that you can integrate aviation assets pretty well into the other two organizations without running a serious risk that you're really going to lose out on capabilities.
We'll go back to our callers now. We've got Bobby with us in Lake Holcomb. Bobby, hi.
Hello. How are you?
Good. What do you think of this?
I think that this is the wrong question at the wrong time. We need the United States Air Force. I'm a retired Marine. The United States has never fought a war since World War I, where we did not have air supremacy. Now, you can talk about strategic bombing campaigns or close air support, but the Air Force has adapted. And we cannot do without the United States Air Force. I mean, the better question would be, and I shiver to say this, is do we need a Marine Corps?
Well, that's quite a question from a former Marine. Bobby, thank you so much for making that call. What do you think, Robert? The Air Force has been a vital part of air supremacy in every war we've been in since World War I. Why get rid of something that's working?
Well, I guess I want to answer that in two ways, and the second way is going to refer to the Marine Corps specifically. First, we have other services that have achieved air supremacy in the wars that we've had since we've had an independent Air Force, and that has been the United States Navy. In the Vietnam War, there's virtually no question among historians that naval aviators were superior to their Air Force counterparts in fighting, in conducting air superiority and dogfighting, in fighting the North Vietnamese Air Force. And this was due to a variety of reasons. They had better equipment than the Air Force counterparts. They had better training than their Air Force counterparts. And so that in and of itself leaves questions in my mind that you absolutely need this independent organization in order to achieve air supremacy, right? Because we've done it with non-independent organizations in the past that come up with better stuff and that come up with better training. And the second part, and this is, people bring up the Marine Corps a lot. You know, the Marine Corps right now is in the midst of essentially mortgaging its entire future to buy fighter aircraft, in part, not entirely, but in part, because it doesn't feel that it can rely on the support of the United States Air Force to do what it wants. And this is, you know, will it have close air support? Will it have interdiction and transport that it depends on the Air Force to provide? And the Marine answer has been no. And because it's no, the Marine Corps is spending itself almost into bankruptcy, buying expensive fighters and expensive transport aircraft.
Well, thank you for that call, Bobby. And we move next to Bill in Merrill. Hi, Bill.
Hi. The question I have, or the point I have, is that the Air Force has a strategic responsibility that is not shared by the Army, the Navy, or the Marine Corps, although the Navy has missile assets that are pretty equal to what the Air Force has as missile assets. The Army's Air Corps, or Air Supplement, is tactical, with helicopters to support and to transport troops, whereas the Air Force is working with strategic responsibilities instead.
Okay, thanks a lot for the thoughts, Bill. And Robert, what about that the Air Force has a specialized mission and it doesn't quite mesh with the other aims of those branches?
Well, again, there are two ways to answer this. The first way is that some of the assets that, I'm not arguing that we entirely shutter every capability that the Air Force has, right? And it's more complicated simply than we'll repaint the insignia on Air Force aircraft so that they read Navy or Army. But in some cases, it's literally that simple, that you will simply transition, as we've done in the past, aircraft from one service to another. And so you'll retain some of that capability. But the caller also gets to a pretty good point in that, the Air Force does have this specialized strategic capability. But in my view, and I think that history bears this out, this strategic capability, strategic long-range strike for decisive political effect, is the thing that the Air Force does least well. And that it's this thing that we should really very seriously think about. Is this something we really want to devote a tremendous amount of our military resources to? Or do we want to focus our resources more clearly on the things that air power does well, which is being in support of naval operations, being in support of Army operations, so that you have two very effective services that do things very well, rather than sort of spend a lot of gambling on the promise of strategic air power?
And speaking of spending, do you see money saved in making this transition, or at least money better spent?
I see money better spent, certainly, and I think even in the fairly short term, we see money better spent. The money saved comes more in the medium and the long term, where we transition away from spending tremendous amounts on maintaining strategic long-range strike capabilities, and we focus more on making our military services as effective at the operational and tactical jobs that we want them to do. The spending savings we get from eliminating redundancy, we get from changing the way we train, and in long-range procurement, we get less expensive aircraft in the long run.
As we wrap up here, it seems as though getting rid of the Air Force would be difficult. It would take a long time to accomplish. In the meantime, are there steps that could be taken right now to get at some of the issues that you're worried about?
I think that we can take steps even in the short term to ensure that the services work better together, especially with respect to procurement. Procurement is an area where each of the services still primarily decides on what it wants without thinking over much about the requirements that other services have. And I think that reforming the procurement process so that it goes in more joint direction, so that you have more of a conversation between the three services, is a good idea. I think that would solve a lot of the problems associated with the F-35. I would say also that breaking the golden rule is something that's been around since the 60s, where essentially the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force all get roughly equal amounts of the budget, no matter who we're planning on fighting, no matter what the strategic environment looks like. You always essentially give each one the same amount of money, is something that really needs to be broken. That's the biggest problem we have, and that reforming that will go a long way to solving some of the short-term problems we have.
Robert, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you.
That's Robert Farley. He's an assistant professor at the Patterson School of Diplomacy and International Commerce at the University of Kentucky. He's the author of the new book, Grounded, The Case for Abolishing the United States Air Force.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up in our Curious Wisconsin segment today, we'll look at the contributions of Eau Claire and Western Wisconsin to Major League Baseball and talk about how one of the greatest players of all time got his start in the Chippewa Valley.
First, State School Superintendent Tony Evers just announced the formation of a task force charged with recommending solutions to the racial achievement gap in the Milwaukee area and across the state.
The announcement comes months after a national assessment that showed that the gap between black and white students in Wisconsin was the widest in the nation, and days after a report that ranked the state as the worst in the nation for African-American children.
The task force is being led by Damon Mean, superintendent of the Mequon-Thiensville School District, and he joins us now to talk about what he hopes to accomplish. Damon, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, as we said, you're heading up this new task force to help close the achievement gap. It seems like starting with Milwaukee and then extrapolating out to the rest of the state. Why is this the right time for a task force like this?
I think it's the right time because we have known as educators in the state of Wisconsin that children of color, not only African-American students, but Hispanic students have ranked near the bottom when you look at the National Assessment of Educational Progress, or the NAEP results. And as a state, we continue to talk about increasing job opportunities and making our state more appealing from an economic standpoint. If we are ignoring the educational pursuits of children of color in our state, then we are failing our children, but more importantly, we're failing to prepare Wisconsin for the future.
It seems like there's been a lot of bad news about student achievement and racial disparities in schools in Wisconsin and in Milwaukee this year alone. When you get together with other educators, what do you think about this? What do you say to each other about it?
What we say is that we have to do a much better job than what we're currently doing collectively. And I think the other issue that we're really excited to tackle, State Superintendent Tony Evers and I, we're excited to tackle the issue of perception with this task force. When you talk about the fact that there are children of color who are underperforming in our state, typically people will turn their attention to Milwaukee or Racine or Madison, all the urban areas of our state. But when you see the migration of families of color in our state, people are living in non-urban areas now, so it's not unusual for families of color to live in areas like Toma or Superior. And so this is a statewide issue. It's not a Milwaukee issue or an urban issue, but it's truly an issue that we all need to get our arms wrapped around if we're going to make Wisconsin a brighter place for the next generation.
Have you gotten far enough along to know what your major goals are?
Yes, we do have three major goals. The first is to examine and recommend proactive instructional strategies to close the gaps among our children in Wisconsin. The second is to develop a resource for Wisconsin teachers, principals, school board members to use as they're working towards closing the achievement gaps. And then finally, some governance suggestions for school board members as they work towards closing the achievement gaps as well. So we want to hit all three levels. We want to hit the classroom level, clearly, but also school-wide strategies. And then finally, some strategies that school board members can utilize in their role as governance leaders.
And what can you tell us about the makeup of the task force? Who are the other people joining you in this?
Sure. We have a really exciting group that we're bringing together, and we're really excited about who will be working with us. We took a look at schools across our state who are demonstrating work and progress in closing the achievement gaps. We have teachers from Fond du Lac, Beloit, the Madison Metropolitan School District, West Dallas, West Milwaukee, Janesville, the Menominee Indian School District, Oshkosh, Wausau. We also have educators from Racine and Sun Prairie and Green Bay. But we're also working with our charter and voucher colleagues as well. So there will be members from the that community and that school community as well, Notre Dame Middle School and St. Marcus and other places as well. I think we have a very diverse group of educators who will come to the table and help us address this issue. But Dr. Evers, State Superintendent Evers, had a vision that he wanted to ensure that the task force was mainly comprised of teachers, people who are working in schools and who are achieving great success in closing the gaps. And I think that's the most exciting element of this task force.
Now, there are education pundits, Diane Ravitch is one, who say that you'll never close the achievement gap until you tackle poverty. Do you imagine looking at issues like that that extend beyond school walls, or will it stay strictly within the school?
Well, I think we're going to have to look at some elements of poverty and how poverty impacts children and their learning. But I think ultimately what we want to focus our primary attention to is what can we do once the children come to the schoolhouse door? What can we provide as an educational institution or an organization once those children come to our schools? And that's going to be our primary focus. As a side note, I serve on a committee or group. It's called the Social Development Commission in the city of Milwaukee. We, with the SDC group, we're actually looking at the poverty issue closer than what this task force that Tony Evers has put together. And so I guess the walk that I will be involved in the next few months will clearly address not only the instructional side of things, which is the DPI task force, but I will also be working with our SDC task force on looking at poverty and how it impacts children as well.
And you're not just dealing with the divide between black students and white students. There are other racial gaps you'd like to address as well.
Absolutely. As the NAEP scores showed, our Hispanic students are underperforming in our state, but I'm also concerned about subgroups like our economically disadvantaged students. I'm concerned about our special needs students. There are a lot of subgroups in our state who are underperforming when you look at their test scores. But it goes beyond test scores, I think. I think this also has to do with the type of connections that these young people feel that they have with their local schools. And typically, when a child feels connected to the school that they attend, they perform better. And so not only do we want to address the gaps that we see from standardized test scores, but we also want to make sure that our schools are welcoming places for all subgroups, regardless of the location of the school.
Now, closer to home for you, what approaches have you used in the Mequon-Thiensville district to try and close the racial achievement gap?
We have we've used a few different strategies. I think the one that we're most proud of is that we established a teacher-led group called the District Equity Leadership Team. And so it's a team of teachers, but there's also some principals on the team that look at our data. They lead professional development opportunities for our teachers inside the district. They teach our teaching force how to be more culturally competent. And so we felt that it was crucial to make sure that our teacher leaders were leading the charge in delivering the message around cultural competency. Anytime that something like this is top down and administrators are telling teachers that this is what you should do, it never works. Teachers respect one another. They respect other teachers. And so we felt that developing our district equity leadership team was something that was very important. It may sound small, but another strategy that we've used is that we've started talking about the racial gaps in terms of student performance very candidly and frankly and openly. Typically, educators are uncomfortable in talking about racial issues and racial performance of subgroups. And so what we've done in our school district, we've made it safe to talk about these issues and to address them with strategies. The last thing I would say that we've done is we've continued to try to make our school communities a welcoming place for all students, regardless of the subgroup that they belong to. Those are three very tangible strategies that we've utilized in Mequon-Thiensville. And if you look at our state report card that's issued by a DPI, we do very well in closing gaps based on that objective metric.
Damon, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, and we appreciate you following our work.
Damon Means is the superintendent of the Mequon-Thiensville School District. He was just chosen to lead a task force to address the racial achievement gap for students in the Milwaukee area.
It might not feel like spring outside, but it is. And for sports fans, that means one thing: baseball season is back. Major League Baseball kicked off its 2014 season this week, and while the Brewers might not be off to the hottest of starts, it's hard not to feel optimistic about a new and still wide-open season.
But it's also fun to look back at some of Wisconsin's baseball history. And it turns out that for many years, the Chippewa Valley was a hotbed of promising young baseball players. Some of them would go on to be household names. In this week's Curious Wisconsin, we look at Western Wisconsin's baseball heritage and learn more about some of the greats who played ball in Eau Claire.
Joining us now is Jerry Poling. He's Assistant Director of Communications at UW Stout and the author of A Summer Up North, Henry Aaron and the Legend of Eau Claire Baseball. Jerry, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, I guess for a lot of years, Eau Claire was home to a team initially called the Bears, then the Braves. What can you tell us about the team?
The Bears and the Braves played in Eau Claire Class C minor league ball from 1933 through 1962 and had some of the better teams in the Northern League throughout those years. And the Northern League consisted of teams Superior, Wausau, Fargo, Duluth, St. Cloud. It was a highly regarded Class C minor league, and Eau Claire won several pennants throughout that time and developed a number of really well-known players. And there were also a number of great players, obviously, who came through Eau Claire playing for teams throughout that league.
So how did Eau Claire, this place in northwest Wisconsin, end up having this hotshot baseball team?
Well, Eau Claire's baseball history, much like many communities in Wisconsin, goes back to the 1870s, 1880s. We had town teams here in Eau Claire for, you know, throughout the late 1800s, early 1900s, and then the minor league team just happened to develop in 1933, and eventually became affiliated with the Boston Braves, and then the Eau Claire, or then the Milwaukee Braves in Milwaukee when the Braves moved to Milwaukee in 1953. I think part of it was the town tradition, great town teams over the years, and some good players who came out of there, including one player in the Baseball Hall of Fame named Burley Grimes, considered the last spitballer in Major League Baseball, played against Babe Ruth. He played his first minor league season, even though it wasn't professional minor leagues, in Eau Claire in 1912, I believe it was. So there's a real long history of solid town and semi-pro baseball in Eau Claire before the minor league professional teams actually came to town.
We'll name some more names in a minute, but this Northern League that the Eau Claire team was part of, was it a big minor league for people who went on to the majors? Did we get a lot of names out of there?
Yeah, there were some outstanding players who came through. Even though it was considered Class C ball, it was considered by today's standards probably closer to like a double A, because there were just a lot more minor league teams Major League teams had more minor league teams back then. So there was just and baseball was the sport and kind of the only really big sport back in the early 1900s, unlike professional football today. So any great athlete who came out of high school or college, he probably wanted to play professional baseball. So the competition at the pro minor league level was just incredibly tough. So there were lots of great minor league teams. And, some of the players who came out of there, in addition to, I'll mention maybe in a bit some of the Eau Claire guys, but Roger Maris, who broke Babe Ruth's record for home runs in one season, came out of Fargo in the Northern League. Lou Brock played at St. Cloud. Joe Pepitone played in the league. He was a future star for the New York Yankees. Don Larson, who threw the no-hitter in the World Series for the New York Yankees, came out of the Northern League. You could go through dozens and dozens of really fine players who came out of that league. And, of course, Eau Claire having Hank Aaron was a prime example of some of the talent that was in that league from 40s, 50s, 60s. And then the Northern League kind of died out in the late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah, and let's go back to Hank Aaron now. That's a huge name to come out of the league in Eau Claire. How did he first end up there?
Well, he got signed he was playing for the Indianapolis Clowns and got noticed by some of the scouts and got signed by the Boston Braves. And they assigned him to come to Eau Claire because it was considered a good starting point for a young player like that who had no professional experience other than just a spring with the Indianapolis Clowns. So It was, you know, really an interesting experience for Henry because he had grown up playing only with other black players in the South and on the Indianapolis Clowns team, so had never really been in an unsegregated area, really traveling with the Clowns or growing up. And then he lands in Eau Claire, this northern city that has really only, I think, one or two other black people in town at the time. He'd never been that far north in his life, had never, you know, played against a white player, had never batted against a white player. It was a completely new experience for him culturally. And then, of course, just the minor league part of it as well was he was playing professional, organized, highly organized baseball for the first time.
Do we know anything about what Hank Aaron thought about, you know, this town where he was one of, you said, two or three black people in an all-white, otherwise all-white community?
Yeah, it was, you know, he would probably tell you that it was very uncomfortable for him at first. He just felt out of place. There were two other black players on the team that year, and one of them was Wes Covington, who went on to play for the Milwaukee Braves. But he was a shy person, he would say, and he was only 18 at the time. And when he got here, he didn't really know, you know, where he could go safely, what he could do, you know, with the segregation in the South. He was very careful about what he did. But so I think the first month was a real challenge for him, just trying to adjust to a community that was totally, totally different culturally than where he'd grown up. But then once he kind of settled in and realized the people were nice, they were going to treat him fair, and that he was actually playing well on the field and he could hit.
Yeah, what was that season like? Was he a breakaway star right away?
Pretty much. I mean, yeah, he was one of the guys that was considered to be potentially a phenom, kind of like a Willie Mays. And the Milwaukee Braves and Boston Braves scouts, actually we've been Boston Braves that year, they would call Eau Claire every day to see how he was doing. And one of their messages was, because Hank was considered such a naturally great hitter, they said, whatever you do, don't mess with his swing. Just let him hit the way he naturally hits. So, yeah, he ended up being Rookie of the Year in the Northern League. He hit .336, made the All-Star team after being in town for a little over a month, about a month and a half. Yeah, he was an eye-opener in terms of his hitting ability. He only hit 9 home runs that year, so he wasn't showing the type of ability where you would say, he's going to break Babe Ruth's home run record someday. No, he was 155 pounds soaking wet at that time. Pretty not filled out, really, and wasn't a home run hitter, but an incredibly great contact hitter already. You know, he only struck out, I think it was 13 times or something the whole summer. It was just amazing. You know, he just got the bat on the ball all the time.
Do people in Eau Claire have any memory about what he was like just as a person?
Yeah, you know, people said he was shy, like, and he said that himself. He was quite shy about his surroundings, and there was a young woman that he became friends with that summer, and she would say, you know, she had to make jokes and kind of like, engage him because he just wouldn't say a whole lot. He was just kind of a quiet young man and still adjusting to a different environment. But yeah, everybody said, though, that he was just a nice young man, really, you know, really friendly when you got a chance to talk to him, very hardworking on the field. His teammates loved him. You know, he was just a great player. So yeah, I think it was really, you know, when I wrote on this book, when I got done with the book, it kind of dawned on me that really I think this was kind of that seminal summer in his life where, you know, he went from boyhood to manhood, being away from home that far away for the first time, and really getting a chance to see if he could make it on his own and make it in a strange environment. And I think it kind of steeled him for some of the challenges he would face later in his life when he was breaking Babe Ruth's home run record in terms of, you know, can I handle a difficult situation? And I think he came out of that season saying, I can play baseball in the major leagues. I can handle things on my own. I'm on my way.
So why is the Eau Claire team, the Bears or Braves, no longer with us?
Well, most minor league teams started to falter in the early 1960s when baseball started to expand and something known as television started to become very popular in people's homes and people could watch baseball on TV all of a sudden. And minor league teams' attendance dropped precipitously in the early 1960s, and that was what happened in Eau Claire, just like many other cities. The attendance really kind of the bottom fell out of attendance for minor league baseball. In Eau Claire especially, there was prior to the 1960s, there was the only place to go see a pro baseball game was the Chicago Cubs. And all of a sudden in the 1960s, now in the 50s, you've got the Milwaukee Braves, a few hours away, and you've got the Minnesota Twins now an hour and a half away or 2 hours away. So that ate into attendance as well. So it really became a money thing. The major league team didn't have enough to support all of the minor league teams. They started cutting back, and then you had fewer fans going to the games. So minor league baseball kind of dried up in a lot of towns.
Jerry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much. It was great being on your show.
That's Jerry Poling. He's the author of A Summer Up North, Henry Aaron and the Legend of Eau Claire Baseball.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll find out why we all seem to be overwhelmed in our day-to-day lives and how we can work, love, and play when we don't have the time.
The Wisconsin Film Festival began today. We'll talk with a UW grad and director of one of the films playing at the film festival this weekend.
And we'll be joined by our news guy, Noah Ofshinsky, who'll drop by to round up the state news stories of the week.
That and more coming up tomorrow right here on Central Time.